You are listening to the Experience Points podcast for the week of January 23rd, 2019. And cowboy up, it's time to do the Red Dead debrief.
Welcome back, everybody. This is the Experience Points podcast. My name is Scott Juster.
And I'm George Alborn.
We are the co-creators of ExperiencePoints.net. It is a serious but not humorless conversation about video games, and the time has come.
At long last. Hundreds of hours later.
Hundreds of hours later, blisters on my thumbs and saddle sores.
Oh, God.
It's time to talk about our Red Dead Redemption 2 debrief. We finished it up, gosh, towards the end of the year, but then end of the year madness happened, and then some other things happened, and so we're finally getting around to really doing the spoilerific debrief, and here it is.
You know, there was always another job to do, you know?
One more job, George, and then we get to Tahiti.
We've talked about Red Dead Redemption 2 a couple of times. We did a part one debrief pretty early on. Neither of us had played much of it. We talked a little bit about it in our end of the year podcast. So we're going to go in real deep. We'll probably get the spoilers pretty fast because I feel like a lot of my... I'll just say this right off the bat. A lot of my feelings for Red Dead Redemption 2 shifted dramatically over the last... half, and especially the last, say, eighth that 100-hour journey or so. And I think at the end of the day, you know, I kind of like it, actually.
Yeah, it's, I don't know. There's just so much to unpack. I mean, where do you want to start?
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about, you know, we awarded, congratulations again to Red Dead Redemption 2 for being... Was it the gamiest game?
It must have been the gamiest game, right? God, did we already forget?
I know, dude. It's already 2019. I put 2018 behind me. Well, in addition, beyond that, it was also nominated. It had its own category in our gamies, right? For the most superfluous system in Red Dead Redemption 2. And I think that's a good place to start because I'm not quite sure that that ever got better. Like, there was never really a moment in the game where I said, oh, I get it. I respected it. You know, I gave it the time that it demanded of me. But I don't think that even though I'm coming back to this game afterwards saying, actually, I do kind of like Red Dead Redemption 2. I don't think that mechanically speaking, it's really any good at all.
Yes. And by the way, for the record, it was awarded the gamiest game of 2018. Well deserved. There was a late contestant of Super Smash Brothers.
That's Ultimate. Right.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah.
I very much agree with you, and I feel like we've touched on this in various episodes, but the game, gosh, I mean, it is... In a weird way, it's somewhat impressive that they decided to put all of those systems in, everything down to, like, growing your hair to you get stamina, you can increase your stamina, you can increase your horse's stamina, but so many of those systems are totally pointless.
Yes.
And I don't know... A lot of people are like, oh, it's the immersion, blah, 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 but I mean, it almost feels like... The problem is, and I was comparing this to a lot of other games, because we like games. I feel like both of us, especially in recent years, have really, really gotten into very systemic games. And I think one of the reasons we've gotten into it is the games that we like that are highly systems driven, whether it be Spelunky or Dark Souls or Into the Breach or anything that has puts a lot of priority on many arcane systems, is that those systems have meaning. They have merit. Yes. They impact the game, and they must be attended to. Whereas it felt like no one system in Red Dead Redemption 2 needed to be attended to in such a way that it actually added value to the game.
Yes. Yeah, I completely agree. I think There are a couple of exceptions and a couple of, I mean, I don't want to forgive it, but there were times when I was, especially later in the game, when you are trekking from very far distances, like during the section when you are at the Indian encampment.
Yeah.
There are times when you are literally traveling by horseback for 20 minutes straight.
Yeah.
Getting from one, at least for me, getting from one location to another. Right.
Yeah.
And there were times when that was happening that I did have a sort of begrudging respect for the sheer audacity of forcing me to do that.
Yeah.
And there's a certain element of commentary on Westerns generally as these sort of quick bites of action and mythos, you know, like we are used to the sort of high tension Western films and genre in particular. There are a few exceptions, but for the most part, a lot of Westerns are relatively quick and fast paced, and they only have all the fun adventurous parts and not a lot of the sort of nitty grittiness of it. Before we started recording, we were talking a little bit about The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, which is another Western by the Coen brothers on Netflix. And they do this too. There's one of the episodes of that sort of mini movie series. They're on a wagon train, and there's all just this mundane, dumb shit that you have to do when you're on a wagon train. Like her dog barks all the time, and the guy like offers to go kill her dog for her and stuff. Like there's just a silly sort of slow dullness to the reality of like actually sort of making your way as someone that is a sort of the Western hardened criminal that we normally know and love, right? And I can respect it for that. I really do. There were moments when I was admiring the landscape and thinking, you know what? I'm glad that they've really instilled a sense of wasting time and vastness and emptiness, because I think that's something that rings true from the perspective of just like the West and that space and that time.
It is. There is a lot of, I think audacious is the right way to put it. I mean, so many times in this game, I was like, man, I very much disagree or dislike what this is, but I very much respect it.
Yes. It's like a radical chef. You know, you're like, you know what? Sea urchin's not for me, but it does look like a moose, you know? So I got to give
good
it
on
you.
Good on you.
Good on you.
I think, and all this is, of course, wrapped in what is an amazing looking game. You know, they really, you can see what they were going for. And in a weird way, I almost think that they achieved it. It's just, I don't know. It almost seems like it was out there to like, okay, can we do this? But yeah. I mean, should we do it? I don't know. You know, I don't know.
Those that fools.
Like, there's also, I mean, I would also say that they're, in many ways, I've said this before, but this game feels very dated in some very strange ways.
Mm-hmm.
Even to the point of it, so many times it locks you into certain behaviors where, like in camp, you cannot run,
yep,
or you can't draw your weapon, or if you're on a mission, if you deviate from the scripted outcome of the mission, it will fail, even if you were completing the spirit of the mission.
Yep.
And after so many years, that sort of thing really stands out, where there are so many games out there now, whether it's something as extreme as, Hitman, or, you know, something like, gosh, what was Dishonored, you know, those type of games where it's like, there's definitely a mission, there's a more scripted way of doing it, but really you can do it any way you want. And it really stands out in the intervening 8 years before, you know, after Red Dead Redemption 1 came out and this game, that stuff just ages so poorly. Like there were multiple times where I was like, oh cool, like I'm gonna do this, I'm gonna get up onto this hill and like ambush the people, and then it was like failed. Like what? Like what happened?
Yeah. Well, and then I think even more than that, there's a sort of obligation to onboard your players a little bit better, that those are the rules that we're playing by.
Yeah.
You know? Because it's not just that they have this old system, and there are times where that audacity of committing to that simulation is rewarding, because I think those moments are there. Mm. But when you're talking about players coming to this world, some people are playing this for the first time. They've never played the first Red Dead Redemption. They've never even maybe played a Western video game. I can't even think of very many Western video games, let alone open world ones from the past, you know, ever. So I don't think that you can go at it and expect people to take what you're offering for granted and go, oh, well, they'll get it. They'll figure it out, you know? It's kind of like, you know, like reading an old college essay or something, and you realize how bad your writing was, you know? Yes. Like, at the time, you may have thought your ideas were great, and maybe they were, right? Yes,
yeah.
But there's a lot to be said for people who can articulate their ideas in a way that is accessible to the reader, even if you as a writer think it's great. And I think that's what Red Dead Redemption 2 suffers greatly from, because there are some really interesting stories and ideas here. But if you are having your players stumble to get access to it, or the gaps between those moments are so long and far and confusing that by the time they get back to the storyline, they've lost the thread, I think you're really sacrificing what could have been a really enriching experience for players from a narrative perspective, because you've sort of fumbled the sort of unspoken agreement you made with a player that this would be a game that would be accessible to you.
I also am interested in revisiting the first game and GTA 5. And
almost certainly will be revisiting the first game.
Right, yes. Or even GTA 4, because I kind of want to see when this game feels like the most extreme version of the Rockstar mechanical style that I've ever played, in terms of how the player moves, what the button prompts are like, what the tool tips are like, how the menus work. And I'm just interested in the DNA, where it's like, is this actually a radical departure, or is this just the logical conclusion of a trajectory they've been on for the better part of 15 years?
Right.
And it feels like it's very strange. It feels like they learned some weird lessons about what people liked and didn't like about their games. And I don't know. Maybe it just didn't like sync with me or something, but it seems like they almost learned the wrong lessons.
Yeah.
There's also just some really weird shit around how the control works. I mean, everything is really, I was fucking with the aiming settings my entire time playing that game.
Yeah.
You know, just messing with the dead zone, the sensitivity, the acceleration. There are times when they implement the weird, like, Destiny-like, you have to hold the button and then the ring completes and then the prompt goes. And then there's other times where you just have to press the button.
Just smash triangle, Scott. That's what I did.
It's just, it's a really confusing hodgepodge, and just kind of a baffling hodgepodge of UI UX decisions that the first game did better.
Yeah.
Which is weird that you would, I don't know. It's just, there was just a lot of very strange decisions around how to structure that game.
Does it even let you remap your controls?
I don't know. There are some accessibility things where it's like you can set it so that you don't have to tap on the sprint button to keep sprinting.
Oh God, why didn't I enable that?
I mean, but in a weird way, I give that more leeway, because in a very Shadow of the Colossus type way, it's connecting you physically with the mechanic on the screen.
Yes.
Which again, it might be annoying, and definitely probably is annoying if you are my spouse and in the same room and I'm just relentlessly tapping the X button as I play this game.
Yeah.
But there is something to be said for, okay, this is our artistic choice. You know, we are making you at least somewhat physically connected to the digital character you're playing. And like, I can see that, but it's like, okay, sometimes you have to hold triangle to sell something, and other times you have to tap it to sell something. Why? Yeah. Fucking why? You know?
Yeah. I mean, it's the horse galloping that I really would have wanted to have default run.
Yeah.
Because that gets obnoxious.
I mean, there's just a lot of strange decisions. What else should we talk about before we go into spoilers? Because there's just so much to, there's so much depth to plumb in the spoilers.
I think in terms of where they greatly succeeded, I think the environments are stunning.
Yep.
I think we spend too much time in what we would consider the American South, which I don't associate with Westerns, and I don't think they did a good enough job of really validating that as a sort of Western space.
It also is weirdly, I mean, obviously they need to shrink the geography to make the game work, but in a weird way, that part of the world felt really cramped, where it's like all of a sudden I'm in the South and then I ride for 5 minutes and now it's like the plains again.
Well, it's just, it's fucking stupid with gators, you know? I mean, it should make a little bit of sense of where it's situated. But I mean, I liked that city, the New Orleans, the version of New Orleans that they crafted. And I think some of those landscapes are gorgeous. There's a sequence when you're doing a main mission and you're like traipsing through and you see this like massive albino alligator. That's super cool. I liked that sequence quite a bit, but it didn't feel like a Western to me, like in the way that the other parts did.
Yeah.
And then I also want to just give a shout out to the music, 'cause I think the score is fantastic.
I mean, there is a few different, renditions of, you know, spoken or, songs with actual lyrics and singing. There was a few different Willie Nelson was in this soundtrack. We'll talk about my favorite part of the soundtrack at the very end. You could probably guess what it is.
But I
think that I really liked the environment I liked the most was basically everything around the Eagle Flies mission.
The physical landscape there is awesome. When you're up the mountain with him you're seeing the view, you're like, oh my God. That and the hot air balloon section are the two like that really give you a sense of how massive the world is that they crafted.
Yeah, I really like that stuff. I thought some of the... I will also say that despite all of my complaints around the massive amount of mechanical density in this game, it is one of the few games where it inspired me to kind of role play Arthur a little bit.
Sure.
Where there were times where I was like, something really tough would happen to Arthur. You know, Arthur is he doesn't live the greatest life and just bad things happen to him sometimes. And there were times where I was like, man, I need a fresh start. I'm going to go to town. I'm going to drink after that. I'm going to get shaved up, get a haircut. You know, I'm going to take a break. And it was like, man, like there's no mechanical significance to this. I do feel like I am inhabiting what Arthur would feel like. And I thought that was very impressive.
There were a time, I think when you're on the run or something, I was like, well, I'm going to grow a beard. That way I don't get recognized.
Yeah.
You know? And then when it's like, oh, we're going to New Orleans and you have to look sharp. I'm like, all right, time to buy a suit, baby. Here we go. Yeah. Looking good.
And I think that's a testament to just how the weight of all of that mechanical stuff can just press you into role playing. Even the most diehard mechanical people would have a hard time ignoring the role playing aspect of it, which I thought was very cool.
That, and I think most of the camp that you're in, like the group that he surrounds himself in, seem really fleshed out. Like they all seem very real and believable in a way that some of the other NPCs don't out in the world, but that particular crew, when you're around them, you know, there's a couple of scenes actually where they're celebrating and drinking and hanging out. And man, you could ignore all of that if you want, but my guess is most people spend quite a bit of time just hanging around and drinking and kicking it with those folks, because they're kind of a joy to be around.
I mean, it felt like one of those, gosh, what's it called? It's the immersive theater experience in New York.
I was just talking to people about this.
Yeah. We'll think of it in a minute, but there are experimental theater
scenes.
Sleep No More, where you have to walk around the environment and the play is happening around you. And that's what the camp felt like a lot of the time, where you could follow a certain character around the camp and talk to them and just see their daily chores. But there's also, you can hear people shouting in the background and you know something else is happening. It made it feel very lived in, which again is probably why they took away the option for you to be a jackass in the camp, because if you could run and pull out your weapons and do whatever, you could much more easily fuck with that environment.
Yeah. It's just so weird, because it's like, man, we went through this with Uncharted like 3, right? I mean, it's been so long since we've had this conversation.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing, where it felt like we were complaining about the Gears walk and talk sequences in like 2007.
Yeah.
And so it's like, man, like what has gone on in the intervening decade, you know? It's just a crazy, monumental, flawed, amazing achievement.
Do you think that I don't know about you, but I genuinely thought going into this year that this would be in our top games of the year list.
Oh yeah, easily.
And very quickly into it, I was like, oh, this isn't going to, unless they do something drastic. Yes. And they do quite a bit of drastic stuff.
They do.
It's not going to make it. And it did not squeak into either of our best of the games year list.
Yeah.
And it's a weird game to talk about because, you know, I have a lot of coworkers that have played it or are currently playing it because the game takes a very long time. And it's a weird one to broach because when it's like, oh, do you like it? Do you not like it? And there's so many mixed feelings about it. And yeah. Like I have mixed feelings about it myself, and I don't always agree with the people that I'm talking to about it. It's an interesting rarity, I think, to have this big of a lack of consensus about a particular release that was so highly looked forward to.
And not only that, but so highly successful. I mean, there are people that I talk with at work or whatever who definitely are not as serious about video games as I am, but they are playing Red Dead Redemption 2.
Yep.
And it's just impressive the reach of this game, and it's impressive how much it sold and succeeded despite being a rough game, you know, many things that are not very friendly to people that either don't play a lot of games or don't have a lot of time to play games. So it's shocking to see the disparity or the differences between people's reactions to it.
Yeah.
It also makes me feel kind of like a hipster because then you're put in the unenviable position of saying like, well, this super popular thing has flaws, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, okay, well, maybe I should just not talk about it.
Well, it feels a little dated from, 10 years ago when I was also hosting this podcast.
Right, exactly. They're like, shut up, nerd. I'm like, all right, whatever.
All right, I'll talk about it with George.
Yeah.
All right, shall we get into spoilers?
Let's do it.
All right, spoilers for all things story-based, and I guess mechanically based, potentially, for Red Dead Redemption 2 starting right now.
Right now.
Gosh. Okay, before we...
Where do we start? Hour one.
Hour one. So I want to start with the first mission that, to me, showed a ray of hope, because at this point I was really not liking the game.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I mentioned this on the first Red Dead debrief as well. There's a main mission when you're moving camps for the first time. I think it's called a Strange Kindness, mm-hmm. where you encounter a family whose father, a German family, whose father's been kidnapped, and you go and rescue him and you bring him back. I don't know if you played with subtitles on, but if you play with subtitles on, they translate his German into English.
Yeah. I do remember
that. Captioning. To me, that was the first moment where I started to get a better understanding of what the game was about. Because there's the scene when you find the family and Arthur's like, we don't have fucking time for this. We got to go do our own thing. We got to take care of our own. Let's ignore them. And I forget who you're with. I think you're with Charles. And And Charles says, you're not that kind of man. Like, what are you saying? You're better than this, essentially.
Yeah.
And you go and you rescue him and you bring him back to his family, and he gives you like a fat gold stack that you spend on like a sweet dew and a can of beans or whatever before resetting up camp. But I thought that one really encapsulated well earlier on what the key stakes were, right? Which is Arthur is this person that doesn't want to be a good person, or thinks he's a bad person, and is always saying, I'm a bad person. And there are these moments when you put yourself and those you love at risk in order to be a good person. And Charles identifies that in that first scene, and so he helps that family. And you know, because this is shortly after the Pinkertons see you with the kid, and Dutch makes the decision not to move right away.
Yeah.
And you see the similarity between Dutch and Arthur, where they both really care for their the sort of unit that they call themselves family.
Mm-hmm.
But Dutch's obsessiveness puts his family in danger, and Arthur's is the exact opposite. Like, he cares so intensely for his family that and families in general, right? Like, when you save the Germans, that's sort of what it got at, right? Like, the only risk he was willing to take was in the name of reuniting a family.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, that was like, okay, this is the setup. This is the major conflict between these two characters. And then it was bad again for a really long time. Like, I didn't really like the story, but it felt like it was vindicated, because much later in the game when Arthur is, I don't know what you would call it, like a tuberculosis fugue state.
Yeah, he is overcome with his disease.
Yeah, he's like tripping balls or whatever. Yeah. And the German family finds him and they help him.
Yeah.
And to me, that was like, oh, okay, this, the game does get what it's trying to say, because they're making a callback to what I thought was a really important scene very early on that was never really spoken about by any of the characters, but reestablishing that, you know, the good that comes out of the world is the good that people put in it. And that's that moment when Arthur is struggling with that question, is like, did he put in enough good in the world? And I think that question, while I think a significantly less broad question than those that the first Red Dead brings up, I still thought was really interesting to plumb in that last quarter of the game.
Yeah. I mean, I really think that the story would have been stronger had there been less of it.
Yes, 100%.
Because at a certain point, it is clear from the very beginning that Arthur and the people with better moral compasses in the gang know that Dutch is unraveling.
Yeah.
It's basically clear from the first mission of the game, where there was some really good writing where they said something like, they were talking about the mission in Blackwater that went bad, and they never really talk about it all that much, other than they just say, hey, things went bad, very bad. There was a girl that got killed there or something. And right away you're like, okay, well, these people know, they're in denial. These people are in denial. But then it just happens so many times that it just strains credulity that, like, okay, Arthur's not an idiot. Like, he's actually a smart guy. He knows what's going on. It's just that they're cramming so many missions in here. And Arthur, it's weird. At a certain point, I feel like it's around the point where you are in the bayou. Arthur is like, I don't even know who you are, what you're talking about anymore. And then he just goes and does more stuff that Dutch wants to do. And it's like, why is he doing this at this point?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and you know, there are good moments in certain chapters, but honestly, get rid of the two entire, you know, the McCoys and the Hatchwoods or whatever.
That was pointless.
Just get rid of that entire storyline. Get rid of the entire, like, weird Cuba militia uprising chapter. Like, you don't have to pick and choose. Like, there are massive sections that you can just dump right out the window. Yeah. There are cool moments in there. And so, you know, again, if you're listening to this and you love the game and there were those moments in there that stuck out, fantastic. But I think that it really needed to be sharper. And more importantly, I think it needed to be sharper earlier to really stick its message through and through.
Yeah.
In a way that I think Red Dead does a far better job, the first game, than this one ever does.
I mean, to go back to the, I forget what they're called, the Braithwaites and the so-and-sos or whatever. It's also just like the classic Rockstar bullshit of like, we're playing two sides against each other. I mean, it's like, man, how many times have we done this?
Yeah.
And it's also weird because it's like, you're never going to get me to sympathize with ex-slaveholders ever.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Sorry. Good luck. Good luck, Red Dead.
Yeah.
The one thing I'll say though, that scene when they walk up on the mansion at night, fucking awesome. It's so badass. You're like, I'm gonna fucking kill some slaveholders, let's go.
I mean, there were many scenes. I guess the problem is there were a handful of scenes, maybe five scenes or so, that gave me goosebumps, where it was just, and that scene was one of them, where you can see the moonlight kind of sifting through the trees and it's misty and it's just a row of bad men ready to do bad things.
Yeah,
and it's
to, like, bad people.
Yeah, and it's like, man, this is gonna be sweet.
Yeah.
And it was. I will also say, on a side note, did you do the side quest where you found the ex-slave hunter?
I don't think I did, no.
There was a side quest. I didn't do all the side quests, but there was a quest where you basically find a broken down old alcoholic homeless man, and he is like, oh, the bank foreclosed on my home, they took all my stuff, blah blah blah. If you go buy it, can you just please get me my notebook and my compass and my old pistol? It's just sentimental value. And I went by that old house and I went in there and grabbed the stuff. And when you look through the journal, it's a bunch of names and locations and prices or something. And this guy made his living hunting down slaves.
Oh, wow.
Who had escaped. And it was funny because he was like, oh, you know, he was like a pillar of the community afterwards. He had made this turn. And then basically, you know, Arthur confronts him and, you know, tells him to go to hell and like burns everything and tells him that, like, you know, your time is over. I then proceeded to shoot him in the head and put him in his campfire and light the corpse on fire. Cause it's like, fuck this guy.
I'll get, you know, it's either this or a Quentin Tarantino film. You know what I mean? I'll take it where I can get it.
There was a few other scenes. I think one of the scenes during the Eagle Flies mission where you're attacking the refinery or the factory or whatever you're attacking.
You're
just in a line of like, there's like five guys on horseback and you're charging down the hill.
Oh yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah. Oh, that feels so good. Yeah. And they are like quintessential, like Western moments. That's pretty neat.
And of course they have the music that they kind of incorporate some more of the like indigenous sounds to it. Like, it's great.
Even the scene where they shoot the, I forget his name, the Irish friend of yours.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
In the town, and you sort of see it coming, but like that becomes a sort of, the small town, everyone just fucking pulls guns out of nowhere and it just goes from zero to chaos so quickly that was a really memorable moment as well.
There was just a few of those, but I mean, I think you're right where there was just entire swaths of the game where it's like, man, like this, even the Native American stuff I thought was interesting, but treated in a fairly superficial way. There was interesting stuff if they were to have gone further into what does it mean to survive as the colonized.
Yeah.
And I think Eagle Flies has some really interesting speeches where he talks about what are they trying to do to us? They're trying to get us in a position where they have justification to wipe us out. So here's the way we need to survive. And that stuff is all really interesting, but it kind of gets drowned out by the more stereotypical kind of evil army versus the noble hot-headed Indian, and I don't know, just kind of it gets drowned out a little bit.
And it's a strange moment because I do think a lot of the story about how, so like, you know, for the entire game Dutch is moving towards this fictional state where he gets away from the government and they settle down. Right. And I think we can imagine if his fantasy were to come true, they would all move out west. He would buy a huge ranch and they would all ranch together and they would, you know, herd cattle and they'd live happily ever after. Right. But, they cannot do that because they're under the yoke of governmental power.
Yeah.
And I think it was intentional, but maybe not thoroughly explored, was this comparison with the Indian reservation and the idea that, you know, they're trying to figure out how to survive while giving up their power and admitting that they're giving up their power to really be the shapers of their own destiny. Yeah. Right. And one of them is saying, we'll go down guns blazing, which is the sort of Dutch method, right? Mm-hmm. Where your family will die and you'll put those at risk, or the Arthur method and the father method from the group, right? Which is they learn to survive and they keep their own and they abide. You know, and it's not a glorified, heroic way to go. But I think it's a really interesting thing to explore, connecting those two storylines. And I think it's a little bit there, but they don't really hit on it.
Yeah, it's so. Part of it is just weighed down by the consistent need to draw the tension between Arthur and Dutch, and it's like, we get it. Like, you've done this same scene at least six more times previous where it's like Arthur is losing faith in Dutch. Like, not every mission has to be about that if you've already made the point. And also at that point, it's like, why is Arthur even interacting with Dutch anymore? You know, it just, from a character perspective, some of my favorite things around Arthur were when he started telling the other gang members, look, you know how this ends. Yes. I want you to leave the camp like, you need to get out. Yeah. And I was like, man, this is a fucking great scene. And then Arthur is like, all right, Dutch, let's go do this thing. I don't even know why we're hanging out. And it's like, well, what did you just tell John 5 minutes ago?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I love those moments. The idea of like subtly undermining Dutch.
Yeah.
You know, and like, Because, I mean, that's the thing is, like, there are moments where, yeah, you know what? Arthur's a bad dude. I killed a lot of people as Arthur Morgan. But the dude cares for his own, you know? And that's something that we do admire in our Western heroes, you know? Yeah. Like, we admire John Wayne alone on a fucking horse against a huge group of Indians, even though he's totally racist.
Right.
But because there's something heroic there about the lengths that you'll go to protect those you love, you know?
Right. And there's something to be said for... You know, this game has, I feel like, has a much more simplistic redemption narrative than the first game. But
yes,
there is something interesting about the redemption narrative is a really slow, consistent build and is set against the fact that at a certain point in the game, you just straight up contract tuberculosis and then spend the rest of the game slowly dying. And it's like, okay, well, I know how the game, like, he cannot make it out of tuberculosis. No one wins against that.
Yeah.
So you get
at least not for another, like, 40 years.
Right, exactly. He got it too early. He just is not going to do it. And so it's like, the rest of the game is about the slow realization and the reckoning of who have I been in my life.
Yes. Yeah.
And in most movies and games and everything, that comes in like 10 minutes at the end. Whereas in Red Dead Redemption 2, it's like 30 hours.
it is the overwhelming majority of the story. And so going back to the call out that I made during one of our previous podcasts, you had mentioned we were talking about the most superfluous system. Uh-huh. And I came to the defense of the morality meter.
Mm.
And this is why I came to its defense, because there's a moment where you realize, and this is actually, and I'm sure the music scene you're talking about, right, when he's running back to the camp and the music is playing and he's clearly like about to be dead from tuberculosis.
Mm-hmm.
And he's replaying all of these things in his head. And so many of the things that he hears in his head are people telling him, you're a good person, you're a good person.
Yeah.
And they were more heavy-handed in it in the last fifth of the game or so. Whenever he's doing something and he's like, oh, I'm not a bad person. Or sorry, he says, I'm a bad person. I've done bad things, yada, yada, yada. And everyone's like, it's what you do with the time you have left. It's what you do with your actions. It's about doing the right thing. And that you can still be a good person even though you've done all of these terrible things. There was a moment when you're hearing that and you see the morality meter and my morality is high, even though he's literally telling himself he's a bad person.
Mm-hmm.
That to me, it kind of worked as a way to vindicate as like, you know what we've been tracking here isn't true morality. It's the way that people see Arthur as a man since you've been playing this game, you know, and having it on the side of like, oh, he's been a good person to me was like, oh, okay, this is a sort of, they're using the morality meter. And again, maybe I'm reading too far into this, but I felt like they were kind of using it to make that commentary. Like, you know, it is the actions that you're taking, even if you have done all of these terrible things, there's something, you know, and maybe you're not a good person in the long run. Maybe if we got a bunch of ethicists in the room, they would say you're a scumbag, but you've done good actions within this particular span of time. And there are people that will be positively impacted by that.
That's an interesting take. I hadn't thought of it that way. The other thing that I realized after playing the game was that the morality meter also dictates some of the cutscenes at the end.
Oh, really?
In terms of what happens when you confront Micah at the end, and whether you get the like glorious sunrise ending or if you just die a more mundane death at his hands.
Interesting. Okay.
But I mean, you know, that is what it is. I thought that it was an interesting way, in a weird way, it was a thing that video games are uniquely suited to, which is telling this super long drawn out story because that's just the nature of the game. They should have cut two whole chapters from this game because it just makes the character seem stupid. But that thing is still worth examining. Which I thought was neat.
The one thing too that I think I really had to get over with this game, so much of our conversation in the first Red Dead Redemption was about what the game said about America and its founding and its sort of the violent inheritance that we've received from the past.
Yep.
And this game just does not really say a whole lot about America. There are moments where it's like, you know, oh, they're throwing the Indians off the land because there might be oil there. And it's like a little haphazard connection to Rolling Rock. And you're just like, this isn't quite working for me.
Well, it's also very on the nose where it's like, okay, we're now like fighting the descendants of a slave upright alongside the descendants of a slave. It's like, it's very, very broad.
Yeah, very broad. In a way that I think Red Dead, the first Red Dead Redemption, did a much better job commenting on as a whole. Yeah. This one doesn't. I think once I got over that and sort of just accepted it as this more intimate story about Marston and his morality, then I was able to, I think, appreciate it a little bit more.
Let's, gosh, there's so much to talk about. We definitely need to talk about the epilogue, and we need to talk about Dutch and and John Marston as a character. Yes. So, how did you feel about Dutch by the end of this game?
I'm with you. I think that his unraveling was strange. Like it never felt like I got enough insight from him in the beginning to understand why he was making this transition, other than, well, maybe he was just always this type of person, right?
Right.
I'm not sure if I'm supposed to get at the end that he cared about money and that was his fundamental drive. I got more the sense that Dutch was doing, he was living his life the way he thought it needed to be lived, and sort of taking everybody along with him, and that people were finally realizing the danger of it. You know, there's this allure of falling in with this charismatic cult leader, which Dutch sort of is.
Right.
And by continuing to follow him down this path towards this imaginary future, eventually you're going to realize you're following a charlatan.
Yeah.
You know? And I don't know. I'm not quite sure. I don't know. I'm curious to hear your thoughts, but I'm not quite sure we were supposed to think that he was evil or vindictive about it or anything. You
well,
know?
I never even got the sense that I could never decide whether the game wanted me to believe that he was actually a charlatan or he was misled or he had just strayed from the correct path. Because even at the very end, they kind of redeem him in a weird way where like he kills Micah in the epilogue.
Yeah.
And then I started getting some real conspiracy theories. I was like, man, you know who Dutch reminds me of a lot? The Housers.
Okay.
Because they're kind of this, they're leading this weird little family on a crazy mission against the rest of the entire world. And they know that they ask too much of their people, but they truly believe in it. And in a weird twisted way, they do care. Like, it seems like Dutch was given a strange redemption that I didn't feel like he earned or deserved.
Yeah.
But he got it anyway. And we didn't get enough of the background of why he actually unraveled. Like, why did he unravel? And we just never, I don't know. It just felt like the game was too easy on him at the end.
Yeah. I think that you can find in his tent some books that are basically like the ideology that he draws from.
Mm-hmm.
I think the part to me that stood out in terms of defining his character is there's a moment when you are running from the feds and it's you and Dutch. I'm sure you remember this because it stood out in my mind very starkly. And they're on the cliff about to jump into the river and Dutch gives a monologue. And it's almost word for word the same monologue he gives before he kills himself in the first Red Dead Redemption at the very end of Red Dead. And to me, that was like, not only at first when he sang it, I was like, oh my God, like this is so fucking cool. Like they're calling back to this. And it was a very cool moment. But then it also made me realize, like, you know, throughout these moments in particular, you're always saying, oh, there's always another job. You know, Dutch is always he always has this plan. Things are repeating themselves. You know, you move camp, you do this outrageous thing to score big. It's not big enough. Something goes wrong and you put your family at risk over and over and over again. And to hear him say the same dialogue that he provides at the end took the win. It basically retroactively made that speech in the first Red Dead Redemption worse because he's even then he's still copying himself. You know, he's still on the script that he just can't. Yeah, it's still a performance. Like it's, and in fact, before he jumped off, I was even thinking, you know, is this something that he would have practiced in his tent? You know, like he's the type of person that will sort of fabricate a mythology around himself.
Right.
And I think him saying almost verbatim those same lines before they jump into the river and escape was kind of a cool little nod of like, okay, he is this person that is purely ideology driven and will spin a story around himself in order to continue to make himself the head of that ideology.
Right.
You're right though. I think when you get up to the top of that mountain as Marston and he kills Micah, and leaves the gold as well, right? Like, he doesn't take it all with him. And I think there was a sense like, okay, well, this is yours. You deserved it. It felt like, I don't know. I don't know how they would have done this, right? How do you have this final confrontation with Dutch, but still have him be the final confrontation in the first Red Dead?
Right. Yeah.
Like, I think it came off a little bit like a redemption story. You could also read it as he knew that Micah was a piece of shit, because everybody fucking knows it. And Dutch, while ideologically driven, is not a dumb man, you know? Right. So I don't know. I think there's a lot of ways to read it. I'm not quite sure they fully give him a redemption arc, but I see what you're saying for sure.
Yeah, it was, I just didn't know. It's like, am I supposed to feel grateful to him? Like, this guy is an asshole. Like, he destroyed everything and everyone, but is this supposed to be okay now that he did? I don't know. It was just it was a very strange way to leave that character.
Yeah. Well, at least Micah died, though. What a piece of shit.
what an amazing piece of shit. Great villain.
Great. I mean, hey, top-notch voice acting, because that guy, man, the whole internet hated his fucking guts for a good solid 3 weeks. You're like, man, good on you, dude.
Anyone that can be so evil and despicable that you instantly become a meme is just, you're doing something right.
Yeah, just top-notch scumbaggery right there. let's see. A couple other parts I want to call out. The scene where where Arthur gives Marston his hat.
Oh man, such fan service, but I loved it.
I didn't see it coming.
No, I was such an idiot. I was like, man, I'm such a freaking rube. Like, how did I not see this coming?
The feels, dude. And then he calls him brother, and you're like, oh my God, like, like, you're the real father. Like, you're the family, the guy that kept this family together, and oh, broke my heart. So good.
Yeah. What else?
Should we jump forward to the Marston epilogue?
Yes. Okay. This was by far my favorite portion of the game.
Yeah. Okay, good. Yeah, I agree. Well, I think it's a little bit too long, I would say. And there's this weird,
like everything in this fucking game that's too long.
Well, like, why is there this like weird cannibal troop in the woods that you have to fight? Yeah. So weird. There is a moment when Marston is working as a ranch hand, and he wants to be a ranch hand. The wife moves in, and she's like, this is pretty early on in the epilogue, the like 4+ hour epilogue. and the farm gets attacked by some like rival farm and ruffians or whatever. And they're all fighting, and Marston, you know, is doing what is the right thing to do, right? Like, he's coming to the defense of innocent people. He's protecting their property. He knows how to shoot a gun. You might as well use it. Go to town. And there's a guy in the barn. And the guy is like, don't shoot me or whatever or something.
Oh, yeah. The box art from the first one.
Yes. And so it's the box art from the first one. Yeah. And he shoots, at least I shot the guy, right after he calls him a farmhand.
Yeah.
Which was like pushed me over the edge, right? Because like he sees himself as better than that. But the camera, so it's the box art. He calls him the farmhand. The camera turns to then immediately face the barn door, which I saw as a sort of foreshadowing of the final Red Dead Redemption death sequence.
Totally.
Hugs him right before that barn door.
Yep.
And it's so doubly effective because it's exactly his past that leads him to that death in the first Red Dead.
Yeah.
And it's the job of being a rancer is in fact what he is, you know?
Yep.
And that's who he wants to be. The moment he shoots that guy down, right. is him saying he doesn't want to be a farmhand. But when he dies at the end of the first one, that's when he's desperately trying to be a farmhand.
Yeah.
It was so good because that was like, and I think this is true of all of the epilogue. So much of the epilogue I thought was a capstone to exactly why we told that story about Arthur in the first place, you know, like this journey of this guy who's like, you know, saying I'm a good person, I can do good things, I'm going to try to do right by my family. And then he sets up Marston and it's just not quite enough to really save him.
Yeah. I mean, it's so remember when they released the Star Wars prequels?
I try not to.
But I mean, one of the functions of those movies was it disrupted who we thought that entire series was about.
Yeah, Gungans.
And it's like the epilogue and all of Arthur's journey serves to reinforce that both of these games are actually about John Marston.
Yes. Yes, 100%.
And it's a very strange thing to have a prequel slash sequel to a game set up even further the character you started in the first game. And it's almost like they needed that epilogue to justify what this entire game was about.
Yeah. 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 You know, actually, I would really be curious where in the development pipeline they decided to make this at all.
Yeah.
You know, like, were they, I wouldn't be surprised if they were writing this scene from the beginning.
Right. Right. And I mean, I think it's, I don't want to call like Arthur Morgan a bad character. I just think John Marston is inherently more interesting because there's more tragedy, there's more conflict, there's more flaws. Arthur Morgan is generally speaking a good man who just doesn't know he's good.
Yeah.
Where John Marston, the jury is out. I mean, he tries various things. He gets pulled in a very Mythic West type way. He is trying to build a future for his family that he inevitably cannot live in. He's just a really interesting character and made only more interesting and more tragic by what Arthur does for him.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I love the idea that Marston is hesitant about being a father and learns to be a father from Morgan, who's a better father than Dutch is, who people consider the dad of this family unit.
Right.
I love the idea also that, you know, when we first started this game, we know where Marston's future lies. Like, yeah, he's going to be gunned down by government officials.
Yep.
And so that last attempt by Morgan to free Marston from the influences of Dutch and give him this opportunity to be a family, I went into it thinking that is a futile effort.
Yeah.
But the dedication to showcasing Marston's attempt at building a home and a family, specifically also the sequence where he buys like a prefabricated home and builds it and sort of builds his house for his family. Like, no matter what, at the end of the day, Morgan won because he did give Marston a redemption story. It was just a redemption story that we didn't see because it took place before his redemption story in Red Dead Redemption. You know, there was a time where he was a family man. You know, and in that way, Marston's sacrifices were worth it. And I thought that was a really sort of powerful and moving way to transition from Morgan's death to what would become Marston's death without making it feel futile.
Yeah. And I would be really interested to talk to someone that didn't play the first game because, you know, there's an ominous, you know, Pinkerton looking at, or federal agent looking at the ranch at the end of the game, but it's not really that explicit, but it's also just tragic. I mean, you go through that whole thing where he formally asks Abigail to marry him after all these years, he gets his family back, and it's just, you know, it's not going to work. He can't live in that world, and he's fated to fail, but the attempt was noble.
Yeah.
And it was just an amazing capstone to it. I will say the song that I was referring to was the house building song.
Oh, the house building.
I fucking loved that whole thing. It was just such a goofy, hilarious, heartwarming, like fucking uncle with his lumbago.
And he's like drunk on the floor of this like barn and stuff. Yeah. Uncle was choice.
Fucking hilarious. Like,
there was a moment where I was like, you know, they should just do a spinoff. I would play like this whole sequence where just like Marston, Uncle, and Charles, just like the, like, you know, the trio of dudes.
And I mean, these are killers. You know, these are robbers and murderers, and they're making a real effort at constructing the future.
Yes.
Ending the West as they know it and trying to live in the world that they're ushering in. And it's just such a strong moment of that game that it's incredible.
It's also something that the Westerns have done for a while.
Yeah.
Right. But sometimes not so clearly in terms of like physically building the house,
right?
You know? Like the classic, you know, searcher scene where he's waiting outside the home is like, he built this home, but he's off. But he didn't actually build the home in the searchers, right. You know, like
there wasn't a musical QuickTime montage.
Yeah, there wasn't. There should have been, which I think was super effective. I also really like the scene where they get photographed.
Yes.
And you're like choosing different backdrops and you're creating this fantasy around what they could be but cannot ever be.
Yeah.
It was really cool. Also, just the little nod to like the way that we know the town will transform with time and photographs will change with time and we'll look back on history in a different way. Like we look back at old photographs and we forget the fact that they had to hold their pose for an incredibly long time in order for the photo to be taken. Like even there is like the message that you get out of the entire game that is willing to take its time with damn near everything, you know?
Yep.
And how, if we don't understand and respect that, how time felt, we don't quite get a full understanding of how that transition must have felt like then when they are trying to sort of build that new home and confront the future and they're encountering these things.
I was reading a couple, just someone had compiled a little list of allusions and callbacks to the other game. And one of them was every time there is interference by the law, it's a fishing trip where it happens when Arthur and Jack Marston are down there. That's the first time you really encounter the Pinkertons.
Interesting.
Same deal happens like when you go fishing with Jack, you know, in the epilogue, and in the epilogue of Red Dead Redemption 1, you find the Agent Ross fishing in a creek down there, and that's when you gun him down.
Oh, shit, Scott.
And I was like, oh my God, that's amazing.
Yeah.
There was a scene in the end where Jack and Abigail are standing on the little hillside that they're buried in the first game.
Oh shit!
Overlooking their house.
Yeah.
I was walking around in the barn that they had built, and I was like, "This is the site of John Marston's death." Like, I walked through those gates. I was like, "Man," and how many? You know, whatever, 2 years time or whatever the time passage is. Little does he know, but this is his ultimate dream realized. But it's also the end of his journey.
Yeah, man, that's cool. I didn't catch any of that stuff.
I mean, I like I said, I was just kind of poking around at people's write-ups and stuff, and then I was just, you know, walking around, and there's just so many little touches that make that epilogue extremely strong, and also it's just like, man, John Marston, for as much shit as people give him, that's the other thing too. Like, John Marston is not a very smart man. Like, if you look at did you look at his journal entries? Like, he takes Arthur's journal.
Oh no, is he like bad at drawing?
Yeah, he's like bad at writing too. Like you hear these, you know, Morgan has these very poetic and moving descriptions of the various locations, and Marston's are like very basic and kind of poorly written. It's just kind of a funny, like, he's living in the shadow of this father figure, but he's doing the best that he can.
Yeah. Oh man, that's heartbreaking.
And
I think the thing that, to me, despite the fact that I think I took some pleasure knowing that Marston, for a time, had a family. Even if he was doing these like side hustles with Sadie Adler and stuff.
Right.
Who's, by the way, the best character in Red Dead Redemption 2.
Oh, she's great.
The other thing, though, is I was consistently reminded, though, the type of person that, Jack, his son would become, you know?
Oh, yeah. Well, like, and he's like kind of a nerdy, bookish kid, which is even more tragic.
Yeah. And then it gets kidnapped and stuff, and you're like, man, these are the traumatic moments that are going to be defining your life.
Right.
You know?
I mean, that, it just adds, I don't know, people give Marston a lot of shit for being a doofus, but that's just, I feel like his character is even stronger at the end of this game, and I'm even more convinced that he is one of the all-time great video game characters.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. And great voice acting, too, on top of all of it.
Yeah. They just did so much to serve that character, which is weird because like they must really love this character because a good portion of this game was about this character who's not even supposedly the main character of the game.
Yeah. Well, and I think there are moments where it's almost like they don't want you to think that because there's long quest lines where you don't really interact with Marston.
Yeah.
You know, but by the time you get to the end, like, I think it's ridiculous that they had this to be a choice at all. But when you decide to, like, go save Marston or go back and get the money or something.
Oh, yeah. I mean, come, who? I want to know the stats. Yeah,
what,
who goes
what
back?
What asshole? Yeah. Listen, if you're listening to this and you did that.
You're a monster.
You write a letter of apology. yeah, I mean, by that end, you know what he's fighting for, you know?
Yeah.
And a few people have already left camp, but, like, that is. And when he gives him the hat, you know, like, this is his final attempt at salvaging that.
Yeah. Oh man, what a very strange up and down odyssey this whole thing was.
Yeah, it really was. I'm glad we played it. I'm really glad we talked about it, because it's
itching to talk about it, because I was just like, I can't nerd out about it with anyone else, because they'll just look at me like an insane person.
Yeah, well, I was talking to Nicole about it too, and like, we taught that class in college about the West, and I was like, oh man, like, we would be having this conversation in class. Like, I'd be showing scenes from this game, because I think it fits in really interestingly. Those parts only come at the end, but for the most part, like, there's some really, you know, pivotal moments there. And also, we didn't even talk about it at all. There's some crazy side quests that are pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot. There's a lot in there.
Oh, well, it's good to get that off my chest. Now I can just go farm for the rest of my life.
You're not going to go play a Red Dead Redemption 2 online, Scott?
I have not tried it yet. Have you played it at all?
I played it a little bit. I realized that in today's dollars, a can of beans would be $47. and I decided, you know what? I'm going to come back maybe when they fix the economy a little bit. So I mean, I played a little bit of it.
We learned that from GTA 5 online, right? Like, they're going to work on this thing for a while probably. And then,
yes.
Yeah.
I mean, we can literally come back to Red Dead Redemption 2 in 3 years, and it'll be an even better experience.
And people will be like shooting horses out of a gun. Like, the mod scene.
You didn't get the horse cannon DLC?
Yeah, it's. I mean, we'll see.
Oh,
we'll see
side note: they do with it. When your horse dies.
Oh yeah. Wait, what was the most tragic / hilarious horse death that you had? And then I'll share mine.
Oh God, I think I captured this somewhere, but I was like running from people because I accidentally punched a guy and I panicked and I jumped my horse off a cliff.
I stopped a wagon and I basically parked my horse in the middle of the road. And then as I was fighting, I like spooked those horses and then they ran into my horse and killed it.
Oh, yeah. I definitely had some, like, straight-up accidents. I don't think that's possible. Don't horses get out of the way of other horses?
I mean, yeah, you'd think they'd have some sort of horse radar that would, you know, that would somehow preserve their herd mentality.
Look,
but
I'm not saying I know how horses work. Yeah. Hey, I loved my horse, dude. So I did that cheat where you duplicate gold bars. So I bought, like, the prettiest stallion. I decked her out. It was great.
And then when it died, no, Terrence!
Yeah, Archie, sir. Archie was his name.
Oh yeah, well, it was, like I said, it was an odyssey, but I was very glad to get to that epilogue, because that was one of the things that made the whole thing worth it.
Yes, it redeemed the game itself.
Yeah, Red Dead Redemption of Redemption, the redemption of Red Dead Redemption 2. The redeeming.
All right, well, I'm wiping my hands of this game now.
That's it.
We're done. New year,
I'm
new me, baby.
Toss it into the river.
Exactly.
ExperiencePoints@gmail.com is our email address.
And ExperiencePoints.net is the website. You can mosey on down, find old podcasts, including our debrief from way back when on the original Red Dead Redemption. Give it a listen.
Cool. All right. Thank you for listening, everybody. And we will talk to you next week.
So long, partner.
Well, let me have a rule and a saw and a board and I'll cut it. I'll climb up a ladder with a hammer and a nail, and I'll nail it. Well, we worked so hard to build a little house together. In the snow or the rain or the ice cold wind, whenever. No matter what the weather, we're together.